Hello, I'm Greg Johnston. Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2023 season. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a breathtaking $100,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories.
Recently on my bookshelf, I found a copy of Thomas Keneally's Bring Larks and Heroes that evidently belonged to my school's library, borrowed on the 13th of December, 1976. Overpowered with guilt, I returned it immediately, anonymously, to avoid the fine. I mention this only by way of illustrating the length of Thomas Keneally's career. Bring Larks and Heroes was his third novel. For many authors nowadays, that's a long career. This edition sported the epithet, the long-sought great Australian novel. It's my pleasure to welcome Tom Keneally to Imagining the Past today.
Thank you very much.
I'm just always interested with writers. When did you first start to think of yourself as a writer?
I certainly began when I had a short story published in the Bulletin in 1962. As a fairly lonely school teacher, as most people know, I was studying for the priesthood. I left the social life of ex-monks is rather undemanding, and I had plenty of time to. I certainly made time to try to publish short stories. When this happened, when they came out in the Bulletin, I was so fulfilled and affirmed as a failed priest that I really didn't look back from that time. I lived with my parents in who were noble folk in Homebush, New South Wales. I had I shared the back room of our place with my little brother who was studying medicine. And that's where I wrote a novel over the summer holidays of 63, 64, I think, and sent it off to Britain and had it accepted and published that year, 1964. there was a fellow coming to town at that stage up from Nowra called Frank Morehouse, and he was interested in becoming a professional writer, and so from the start was I. I had a layman's knowledge of publishing, and I thought if you can get published in Australia and the UK and the US, then you'll have three pittances to live off, and they might add up to living. And it was maybe a bit easier to do. Well, the market was simply different. The publishers were far more long-term in their commitment to writers in those old days, and fiction was still king. I think it was in that era that the writers got into this idea of alienating the reader, and we alienated them so well that they only read murder mysteries now. And, of course, historical fiction.
What is it that draws you to historical fiction?
The fact that a book is set in the past means that the writer is kind of, what would you call it, jocose enough, genial enough to write a book which will not be utterly confusing to the reader. And so I always loved the past because I never saw it as separate. You know, I had these crazy Irish grandparents on both sides, and they gave me, you know, no sooner was I potty trained than I got the history of Ireland according to them, and the history of the empire at school, and it always fascinated me, the past as a model. I think I always instinctively saw it as a model for the present.
What was the first idea or ideas that you had around Corporal Hitler's pistol?
I have a confession that when I won your great and glorious prize, unexpectedly last year, I didn't... when I wrote the book, I thought of it as somehow near contemporary, a book called Corporal Hitler's Pistol. And it's set in 1916, and it's set in 1933, 2 years before my birth, and the date when Hitler came to power as Chancellor. And I was interested, always have been interested in the echo of great events on Australian communities. I've written a lot of books on, you know, there's a book I wrote on the nurses, which was a very feminist book for an old patriarch like me. And it was about World War I nurses and the struggle they had to get the right not to be bossed around by abusive orderlies. And that story I always saw as connected to the present. And 1933, I thought, was relatively contemporary. So I was delighted to find, and I can see why it's a historic novel, but because it is a hell of a long time ago. But on the other hand, the DNA of modern society is still there. You're really talking about modern society. And talking about a gay cinema pianist in 1933, you're talking about the whole issue of... in talking about the low point in Aboriginal society at that period of time, mid-30s, a time of maximum alienation, I think, when even the white workers were living hand-to-mouth, travelling from town to town collecting a dole, and that is part of the story of the novel too. All that seemed... contemporary, because I saw as a little kid in Wauchope, my parents, who were very, a bit left-wing actually, devout Catholics who said the rosary, obeyed the totalitarian church, but were very stroppy in terms of human rights, you know, the rights, very utopian about Australia. And they brought me out on the veranda one night to watch the railway detectives getting the men out from under the cars. This would have been very close to the beginning of World War II. So the Depression lasted way up, and then there were men travelling from town to town. It's no wonder that one recruit said to a recruiting officer, "Hail Hitler," and he said, "You can't," the officer said, "You can't say that." And he said, "Well, he's the only bugger who's given me a job." Therefore, these issues, the issues behind that book, seem contemporary to me, but they're also historic. You know, the Irish are on the outer. There is a woman who sees undeniably in the features of a half-caste kid her husband's face. And there has been, that was always the great scandal in the town I grew up with. Anyone who went out generally bribing Aboriginal women with sometimes with disastrously bad liquor for their husbands. And so it seemed that the issues were way back, but they were the nascent modern issue. There's the issue of the voice in that an Aboriginal woman coming to be made up by the gay pianist at the cinema. Now, my mother told me about that. She said Chicken used to come, this fellow called Chicken, who was a chicken hypnotist, amongst other gifts that he had. He loved makeup, and he was the town's licensed gay until he put his foot wrong. But he was the clever man on the piano, and he used to love up, my mother said he used to love making up Aboriginal women who were going to town. No one else would let him make them up. And they probably got the best makeup job of anyone in Kempsey, even though they didn't make cosmetics for darker complexions then. They were still crazy about the English rose, you know, and we were still crazy about the English king. There's a lot of my family in that novel because my father was assistant projectionist at the where Chicken played his piano, and my grandfather is in there as a man named Breslin, who has to, he knows he's travelling on the Rattlers, these men going from town to town, and one of them, the story in there of him having a man sitting on top of a boxcar who smashes his head across a railway overpass and is killed instantly, falls off the train, the guard sees him. My grandfather stopped the train, came back, found the body very obviously on the tracks, and they buried him, the union buried him. My grandfather got him a suit from St. Vincent de Paul. They found a lightly franked ticket, which they reused to bring his wife up to Kempsey for the... So that, even at that squalid time, there were men doing fraternal honour to each other. That's when we're best. We're not... there's so many things we're not great at, but we're great at fraternal solidarity. These stories, though, from my family are on the side. They're very much from that great unwashed Irish mob. if you've got your own family in the novel, including the Irishman who won't stand up for the king in the cinema, you sort of don't think of it as historic. And you don't realise that as you get to be older and older, and I'm now 87, your own childhood is an historic novel, even though you think of it as somehow very contemporary because you're still arguing the same crap we were in 1933.
I mean, those contemporary resonances with historical fiction
are, I think,
the thing that really makes historic, or one of the things that really makes historical fiction.
And the other thing that's great is that the oddity of the times is greater than you'd expect it to be. So, for example, I just found out this morning that there was... I'm doing some research into Mary Todd Lincoln because she was known. She had a former Australian convict who used to visit the White House. Now, she was scandalous for using full makeup and being advised by various courtiers how to use makeup at a time when women only wore rouge in the evening because there was a war on. And that sounds an exotic and colourful detail. So this combination of contemporary issues and past oddity is wonderful. I wrote a book on a family who ended up in Mornington Peninsula near Mount Martha, the Balcombes, who were Napoleon's grocers, landlords and intimates on St. Helena. And in fact, they blotted their copybook to the extent that the Tory government was considering pursuing the father for treason because of his collaboration with Napoleon. And they were allowed to come here. The British wanted to get rid of them. They were allowed to come here. And there's something very neat about the fact they got to know Napoleon on the world's, on this small island, this most remote in the middle of the Atlantic, on its own in the middle of the Atlantic. No archipelago, or if there is, it's underwater. The other thing about the past is you get these echoing ironies. So they put Napoleon on the smallest island in mid-Atlantic, and as punishment for these grocers getting too, suppliers getting too close to him, they're sent to Australia, the largest island on Earth. And so those sort of resonances are very important. That's what I love about the novel too. What was taken for granted in the past is not taken for granted now. What was a big issue over which people sweated in the past is not a big issue now. In fact, many of the biggest issues of that time, some of them to do with race, some of them to do with ethnicity, are not worries anymore at all. And that varies from community to community. I like the way the differences and the continuation of issues show up in literary, in historical fiction. So I don't divide them in my head. I think the past is the present, just wearing slightly different underwear and having different habits. All the questions, all the human questions, many of the societal questions are still there. I was delighted. Once you guys gave me the prize, I was willing to believe I'd written an historical novel.
So the novel is very complex, and you've moved across different time periods and places, but it often made me feel like you were doing something and you were playing with like a radio serial like Blue Hills. So there were these elements of...
Yeah, it's highly plotted. Yes.
So you've got this large cast, you've got people connected by a place, you've got fragile and yet secure lines of connection between the people.
Yes.
And they're separate, seemingly unconnected stories as well.
Yes.
So it did make me think of soap opera. Were you kind of playing with that?
No, well, I'm a natural soap opera, Blake. I think I just wanted to put those elements together. I always wanted to write about a woman, wife of a town worthy. And it must have happened in the history of Kempsey and other towns with a numerous tribe, like the Thungudi, that a woman sees her husband's features in a half-caste child. And it's funny, all this stuff about half-castes, even Daisy Bates didn't like half-castes, you know, as if it's there, as if they applied to get born of a white father and black mother. And they were unsettled. Of course they were unsettled. They were torn in halves. I think that must have happened, and that's what I always wanted to write about. But I always wanted to write about this character in Kempsey nicknamed Chicken, who had been the great musician, the Paganini, I don't think he's a piano player, was he? No. He's a violinist. But let's say he's the piano Paganini of the Maclay Valley. And the expertise of these cinema pianists of my, who were still around in my childhood, was extraordinary. But they're all scared of losing their job because the sound cinema has arrived. It doesn't apply to everything that's shown in the film extravaganza when you went to the pictures in those days. It covers cartoons and, well, it, soon after 1933 it did, but it covered also newsreels, which didn't have sound or only began to acquire sound about then. And so you still got silent movies. You still had to have a pianist for when the reels were being changed. You know, the in an attempt to stop the yokels whistling and the Aboriginals in the front stalls, you had to sort of, the idea was that they'll be charmed into orderliness by blokes like Chicken. But there was a real chicken who taught my father how to hypnotize chickens. And in World War II, my father, he served everywhere from Syria down through Palestine into Egypt and across to Tunisia. So whenever he got into trouble with locals, he would hypnotize chickens for them, the scrawny chickens of North Africa. And he'd learnt that from Chicken Weeks, whose father was a sleeper cutter. And the sleeper cutters always fascinated me. Sleepers are made of cement now, I think. In those days, they were cut by men who of great skill who earned very little. And Chicken used to hypnotize chickens for his mother because the family needed them. Maybe the family who owned the hypnotized chicken needed them too, but, you know, I think the Weekses were too were too hard up to inquire into that. And so I was always interested in this extraordinary fellow, Chicken Weeks, who went to jail, as he does, and emerged in the end as a dry cleaner. He learnt how to dry clean in Maitland Jail. But that's post this period in which he is now. We see his arrest and we see the efforts to get him out of prison in this movie. In this novel. Am I accidentally hoping it will be... I would not object, but I know it's a novel. And I wrote it to be a novel. The other thing was that, you know, I go on probably annoy people by going on about the Irish community and how it was despised and hated and so on. It had its advantages, being despised, but there's quite a bit of that still in this novel, because the grandees look upon the Irish like Mr. Breslin, the engine driver, and the Irish over in East Kempsey at the Harp of Erin's store, they look upon them as a lower class. But so they're incredible. There were sort of gentry whites, the bank manager, the accountant. And it seemed when you were in that world, when we used to go to town on every Friday afternoon, that it was eternal. It had always been like this. It'd been, okay, we knew rationally that it was only since 1788, but it seemed an eternal world with its certainties and its vulnerability.
I thought you encapsulated that really well in the cinema, and it reminded me of the cinema in Cinema Paradiso, the film there, which was all about a village coming together, you know, for this one yes. event. But the social hierarchy was in within the cinema, because the gentry were up in the, yes. the first floor, you know. The
Aboriginals in the front stalls.
Yeah. It was very similar to Cinema Paradiso. So I enjoyed Chicken Dalton because he kind of was like the village idiot, and also very necessary, like almost building on an English eccentric character. But also, you know, the effeminate gay man was kind of needed in the village because he was the homosexual.
Yeah,
and all the other men could define themselves against that.
Yes.
Because and like the other character, Johnny Costigan, you know, you kind of queered the pitch again with him, really. So
yes.
I'm just wondering, and Christian Webber, I'm just wondering how, I must disagree with you, though, with Christian Webber, where he states that Mae West was a stupid cow, because I don't think there would be a gay man in the Western world that would agree with you on that.
No. And as a matter of fact, I have just been in Ireland a couple of months researching a murder that happened in my grandparents' village. And I find I've got an uncle, and I've heard about him before, who was in the New York Vice Squad. So we go to Kempsey, and the other Glen Lara Keneally's, his brothers and sisters, go to New York. In some ways, Kempsey doesn't seem fair when compared to Manhattan, but they don't live in Manhattan, they live in Queens. But he was put in charge of closing Mae West in 1826, so closing her down. He was a vice squad cop. Now, he had to close down the dressing room, and she got talking to him, and they had an association in that he advised her, "May, you don't have to pay, Miss West, you don't have to pay this fine for your obscene play. You don't have to go to prison. You could actually pay a fine."
Right.
And she wanted to take prison. Yeah. The other thing is that one of her biographers describes the cops turning up under Sergeant Patrick Keneally in Midtown, and her saying, according to the biographer, "Boys, you can take me as I am, or you can take me as I am." And so, I mean, there is a historical novel, and yeah, yet it's only my grandfather's brother, you know. I was where I was writing history, for example, when I was writing about the Balcombe family and Napoleon. He turns up one day at their beautiful farm on St. Helena by a heart-shaped waterfall, and he asks, can he stay in their granny flat, basically, their summer house? Mm-hmm. And he does that while his house is being. During that time, he proves to be very playful with the kids, quite in an innocent way. And one of the kids, very interestingly, gives him the runs by substituting Cenopod for bonbons in a box of chocolates he got. He eats the bonbons, and he's been told to save one for Napoleon tomorrow morning and give it to Mr. Napoleon. And he replaces the ones he's eaten with Cenopods. So Napoleon eats this constipation medicine and says, "They have sent a child to kill me." He's very worried about poison. "They have sent a child to do it. But in fact, it's not as bad as he thinks." I think it's wonderful to have had a man in Australian history who in his childhood gave Napoleon the shits.
I'm just wondering if we could just have a quick couple of comments on Schindler's Ark, which is obviously a major a major thing. It seems to me now there's still a great deal of interest in stories of the Holocaust, but some of it borders on what I'd kind of call almost Holocaust porn, in that the actual suffering and the significance is diminished to a sideshow. So we've got this endless list of the tattooist, midwife, daughter, librarian, huntress, dressmaker, redhead hyena of Auschwitz. So I'm just, we're a long way from Primo Levi's memoirs.
Yes, indeed.
I'm just wondering what you kind of feel about that, what has sustained that interest in the Holocaust. Because even, Schindler's Ark, the film, is 30 years this year. So
yes,
Schindler's List, sorry. So I'm just wondering what's sustained all that interest. What do you think is...
I think there are two things that sustain it for... maybe three things that sustain it for me. I wonder if I'd been conditioned, as Europeans were, by their own churches, by the general culture, would I have believed in the necessity of obliterating the Jews? Because someone decided, we know who decided, but Hitler wasn't the first one, that the Jews were alien to Western civilization. And Western civilization, said Hitler believed, could not progress unless they were obliterated. So whenever I met Jewish people, I thought, particularly survivors, which was a rare occurrence, I'd think someone, my betters, my metropolitan betters in Europe, wanted you, your oxygen taken away from you, and wanted you obliterated for the sake of the future of European culture, even though there's Wagner and there's Mahler and, despite all that. In any case, in Australia, we weren't classically anti-Semitic. We were reflexly anti-Semitic, but we didn't want to kill them all. We wanted to kill all the Aboriginals instead, sadly, tragically. And there wasn't that classic anti-Semitism in Australia. And so anyone who's not anti-Semitic thinks, how would I have gone if I'd been conditioned like those SS boys were? If my grandparents had gone broke during the Weimar Republic of, there'd been all this misery and squalor, and every day I was told it was the fault of the Jews. And then every day the surrender in World War I was blamed on the Jews. And you go to church on a Sunday and the Jews refuse to accept the greatest prophet, and by the way, he was God in human form, the greatest prophet that ever appeared. And so they must be punished just for that alone, let alone whether you buy into whether they were guilty for killing him anyhow. And so I think we wonder, how would I have gone? And you think, how would I have gone as a prisoner? would I have been persuaded to shoot someone early in the war? And once you've done that, you're gone. You know, you've got to shoot more to maintain your argument. Yeah. And so that's one reason. The second reason is I think underlying a lot of this is the question of, were the Jews supine? Now, I argue in a long article in a book I wrote last year called A Bloody Good Rant that they weren't supine at all. but if you do ship, a lot of Gentiles say, you know, they didn't put up a fight. Well, what about the Warsaw Bloody Ghetto? What about the young Jews who blew up one of the crematoria at Auschwitz? And what about the concentration camp where they blew a hole in the wall, the prisoners, and walked abroad, and they had for a little while.
Well, there were many stories, weren't there? There were two chaps, I've forgotten their names, who hid for a week in a pile of wood, coated themselves in kerosene so that they couldn't be smelt by the dogs, and then eventually got out of Auschwitz and walked to Hungary, gave their testimonies, and were not believed. The Jews of Hungary did not want to believe what they were hearing.
That was Schindler's experience too, because in the book, he goes down to Budapest on a mail train in a compartment full of newspapers, and he tells two German Jews from the rescue organization that works out of Turkey and in what that he has seen Jews killed with carbon monoxide. And they don't believe him. Well, it'd be like being told...
It's so alien.
Yeah. And it would seem like science fiction in those days. The other thing is, I think we're arguing with ourselves, therefore, about the part of Christendom and of Western culture in all this. And then we're arguing about supineness or not, and we're arguing about how would I have survived? And the answer is always by accident, but in our imagination, we always want ourselves to survive by skill. If the Holocaust hadn't happened, it would have been science fiction. It's like Soylent Green. It's as incredible as that old sci-fi movie. It is, upon first hearing, hard to believe in. But ask the survivors. Mm. Ask them to list their dead. And therefore, such an obliteration. And the fact in my case that, you know, I'm a hillbilly from Australia, my metropolitan betters, to whom I felt culturally inferior, did this. We are not blameless. We've had our own. Mm. But this highly technical and organized issue. So when Schindler was talking to these two Jewish men in 42, early 43, he was talking about the experiments they'd been doing with carbon monoxide, expelling gas from an engine into a chamber. And Himmler saw that, and he was sick. So they thought, we've got to do something more efficient. We've got to get through this crowd. Thank God it's going to be 1,000 years Reich. We'll have no problem. In fact, the reign of Zyklon B was not long, and yet it killed so many million people. And if it had been a thousand-year Reich. Well, we now know that Hitler and Heydrich were keen to get onto the Slavs, who are a lower breed of humanity.
Mm. Well, once they've got all that machinery in place.
Yes, and if they went on winning, it would just go on churning out death as a product. I think that's what fascinates, that this was death as a product and no merit on the part of the individual Jew was an excuse for who he was. And no child was exempt either. The children had the poison in them. And so it didn't matter if you were a good musician, if you were a professor of philology at Warsaw University, it didn't matter if you were a very modern style very modern style of Jewish Westerner, a composer, a neurosurgeon, none of that mattered. In fact, you were more likely to go early if you were the neurosurgeon. So I think that is fascinating, that no one was exempt, and that we could get to a stage where we use terms like special treatment, behandlung, I think treatment is, yes. And, you know, such a benign word, special treatment. You know, we give kids with autism special treatment. So it's so sinister with the morality turned upside down. And I think the other thing is that Schindler is a bit of a rascal. Now, recently I went to the Czech Republic, and the family that owned Schindler's second factory has now taken it over, and it's going to open as a museum. This was not available to me when I was writing the book. We're able to talk our way into the factory in Krakow, but we're never able to get into the Russian-run factory in Brněnice, which is a little town in northern Czech Republic. And so now I've been, and Schindler's achievement gets more remarkable now than ever before, because this is a relatively small camp. There is a building in which Schindler and Mrs. Schindler live, but he's got at least two girlfriends with him, and he's having an affair with the SS sergeant in the garrison, the woman sergeant. And he is helping to moderate the behavior of the SS through her. And he is dealing with all those women then. And then he's got 20 yards away the SS barracks. And then just a short walk to it, walk from it, about 30, 40 yards, is the factory itself, which goes deep. It's a long factory. But you can see why he advised prisoners not to walk in the yard, in the quadrangle. But to be able to control all those people and to run a black market operation, as he did, he is more remarkable still. So, and it's as if society was so upside down that only a rascal was any use to you. And that's a fascinating, I still find that. And when I find out that there's a bar in Svitavy, which is up in that textile manufacturing area of Moravia, where this Jewish family had a number of textile mills, And he was arrested as a German spy in 1938. We didn't know that in so many more materials have become available.
It's an amazing story how you found the story, but I just wonder why hadn't, at that point when you wrote the story, why hadn't a Jewish person written this story? Why did it come to you?
I tell you that it wasn't for lack of Leopold Pfefferberg offering it to people. He had people who came in there to just buy a briefcase or to buy a purse for their a bag for their girlfriend or wife, and anyone from the studios he got to know. So there's a perfectly nice man that produced and wrote scripts for a series of a series on TV. And I met, he was one of the blokes to whom Oscar had given the story, but writing a novel on it wasn't his gig. Right. And he was, to continue making a living, he had to keep on writing these episodes. And then there was MGM, Howard Koch, great writer who, film writer, who wrote one of the writers of Casablanca. He was writing a script based on what Poldek.
That was fairly on, though, wasn't it? Fairly early on, wasn't it?
It was, and it had vanished as a project. I don't know why. They were very keen at first. And, well, I know that film people have a very short attention span. And anyone who's ever had a film nearly made knows how short that attention span is. But so there were people working on the story, but no one had written a... Whenever he came to town, Poldek knew these journalists at the LA Times. He'd call them up and say, none of them had written it. And there would have been a book if the MGM film had been made. I'm sure someone would have turned it into a book then. But Spielberg, in retrospect, his view of his second camp is very interesting in that he writes more about the black marketeering. He considers that second camp his ultimate success because he had to bribe the Gauleiter of Moravia to get it put in place. There were no camps in Moravia. To do a stunt like Schindler's List and take people into his own country, he had to persuade the Gauleiter to admit admit concentration camps, Arbeitslager and work camps in Moravia. That itself was a great triumph too. And he told about how he bribed the Gauleiter. He said, he never said, I'm going to pay you diamonds or anything. He said, the other day in Krakow I saw this beautiful diamond and I thought at once of your amiable wife and I felt the two must go together. Would you please pass this to him with my regards? You barely knew you were being softened up. And all those, they're all the reasons, I think, why the man still fascinates. Wallenberg was working out of pure philanthropy. And for some reason, that's not as interesting.
For someone like Katzner and the Katzner train out of Budapest.
That's right.
Because he was like hailed as a hero. And then I've forgotten the exact story, but towards the end of his life in Israel, he was accused of a lot of bad things and I think died quite rejected.
Yeah, I think that to get by in that regime, you had to dance with the devil, and you had sometimes to pay him compliments and do him services.
So if you were to write Schindler's List today, because one of the things I enjoyed about it was your nervousness when you were in the text. You were the author is quite nervous, yes, about what he's doing. Would you write it in a similar way today if you were to write it today?
I think so, but with more information and a bigger section on the second cap and a bigger concentration on on Emily, because Emily is a fascinating study. She's torn. She comes to Krakow for the filming, and then she tells her biographer that she's received nothing. And that's not true. She lived into her 90s, and she said at the end that she still loved Oscar. I'm sure she did. You don't forget a bloke like Oscar too readily. He had a wizardry about him, you know, to be able to deliver stuff.
Well, he must have been so charismatic,
yes,
to be able to just convince these people to do all these things.
Like, yes, that's indeed.
You know, so in a way, you know, he must have had the same kind of persuasive powers that Hitler had, you know, that Hitler,
yes,
was able
indeed.
To... So it's just on the other side of the force, isn't it?
And what fascinates me is that Armin Gert and he are alike. They're both boozers. They're both crooks. If they were in a peacetime village, they'd be considered slightly disreputable real estate agents or something. And the war drove them to polarities. Mm. And that is fascinating, the force of the war on public conscience. I've always felt that we committed war crimes in the war. Hate to say it, I wish it were not so, but that blank carpet bombing of German cities. If someone's anti-Semitic, maybe they are anti-Semitic. Did they deserve to die for it? No, it's not a death sentence.
So as I alluded to at the introduction of our interview today, you've had a very long career, and with the current necessary discussions around who can write what, who has the right to write what, it seems dangerous to me to fall into a trap of only writing what you have immediate access to.
Yes, so, indeed. And the historical novelist can't proceed.
So how have you dealt with that, and how have you kept your writing alive?
I've said in the past that I wouldn't write The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith from within Jimmy. This was a presumption on my part. I didn't see it as a presumption at the time. I have about 30 years ago, I came clean about it. The Aboriginals are such a genial people that I'd never been made to suffer over it the way that William Styron, a white writer, was made to suffer over the Confessions of Nat Turner, which is quite a good book about it. But anyhow, I apologise. I did a session at the with Stan Grant at the Sydney Literary Festival, in which we talked this out, and which I was obviously seeking. You know, when you're in trouble, you just revert to it, to the same type you were when you were seven, and you're trying to get absolution. But that I feel that there's also a special case for the Aboriginals, because they are a group, well, all oppressed groups are a group that have been hurt in more ways than the verbal, but they have had Australia taken from them. They have had bits of it being given back now. They have had their value as individual humans, challenged, assaulted, debased in various ways. And on top of that, you got this bloke Keneally, who's such an imperialist old sod, that he's writing from the point of view of an Aboriginal. Surely their point of view should belong to them. I think there's a special case. I mean, really, there are two things about writing about other people. Could I write from the point of view of an Islamic? Well, if you've ever been a zealot in any religion or a close, you know, a practitioner of any religion, you probably could. But you've got to interview Muslims and you've got to, and you've got to say to one of them, would you mind casting your eye over this and see if there's any unconscious error of sensibility that I've made? And that's what I did with the Aboriginal, the Aboriginal aspects of Corporal Hitler's Pistol. All right, yeah. And what I would do from now on. But I've secretly been writing since the 90s from the point of view of women anyhow. I think there's a woman in me. I think men can. I've even got a theory that our collective unconscious has laid down on us before that secondary issue of where the chromosome goes, whether it's X, Y. I feel we've got every... I now believe that we have a collective unconscious in which all the stereotypes or... Jung called them stereotypes, but he met sort of archetypes. He met... We get many avatars of women dwelling in our own soul, and it takes a lot of effort to cement that all that over. The Australian males in the old days, in my day, did a very good job of cementing it all over. You know, go to a pub, what did men talk about? They talked about sex, but they never said, I think I might be homosexual, you know, I might be, or, you know, I'd like to put on ladies' clothes. They never admitted to any flaws. They never said to their blokes, sometimes I just sit in the corner, I can't do anything. Mm. And it's very healthy that and they're getting screwed all the time. That's the other proposition of men in pubs, you know, where only men gather. They're having sex all the time, so no problems. They tell bawdy jokes, yeah, as if...
But it's very easy to tell stories, yes, like that.
And it's all nonsense. They had lost souls too. When it comes to Aboriginals, I've been... One oppressed group, homosexuals. Just 300 metres up here and to the left, there is a path that takes you to Bluefish. Bluefish Point is just down the path. And this is where that brilliant American kid who'd done his doctorate was tossed over, and his brother made a fortune out of IT and came here and pursued that, because it was always suicide, mysteriously, the coroner decided. Now, that happened just close to here, and it was done by fellow heterosexuals on the basis of the bullshit we were told about this as kids. And I think that random verbal cruelty towards homosexuals can't be countenanced, because it leads to that. Yeah. And I wanted to write about that in the light of poor old Chicken, who had decades to go before anyone who was homosexual would be recognised as valid.
Well, I thought that was really interesting in the book, in the novel, that Chicken avoided the fate of most gay characters in literature, which is they just have to die. And Costigan did. He was murdered, maybe not for his homosexuality, but he still paid a price.
Yes, indeed.
Whereas Chicken was gelded, like he, you know, he went to jail and all of these awful things were accused against him, and he's innocent. But he did come out at the end still alive.
And anything untoward that happens, if the town's favourite sissy, as they would have said, they did say that, town's favourite, suddenly he's no longer this great Blake who can play Dvorak and Schumann. He's
the criminal.
Yeah, it's a very precarious, like, nexus that these people are living on. And it's created because of the guilt and the law and all of the other things that are against it create this position.
So you just wonder in the 30s how many of these stereotyped men in one way or another were killed. And so I wanted to write about that. I also wanted to write about the a sort of ignored aspect of Irish civilization, and I'm sorry to harp on the Irish, but they had, after they dealt with the British and got rid of them, the British said you can have three kingdoms of Ireland for your part, and we're going to keep one kingdom, Ulster. Now, the IRA didn't accept this, and there was a civil war in 1922-23. It began with men who didn't want to fire on each other because they came from the same place. They came, nowhere was it more fraught than down where we came from in North Cork, up against the Kerry border. And in Kerry, it was mayhem. So they began by not being able to shoot at each other. They ended by blowing each other up deliberately, attaching men to landmines and blowing them up by electric charge and so on. The terrible truth is that they did things in the Civil War, which if they did them to, if the British had done to them, we'd hear about it endlessly. Yeah. And fair enough, too. But they did stuff to each other which hasn't been confronted fully. It's just 100 years, and the historian of the Civil War at UCD gave a talk to celebrate the 100th year. And in that period, men who betrayed the IRA, members of the IRA, to this sort of fate, when they were captured and in prison, were sought out and shot. Sebastian Barry, whom I've met, said he had an uncle, and it's in one of his books, who was pursued to Cincinnati and was shot because he served in the Black and Tans. There are a number of stories of people from the Civil War fetching up here. I was in the west of Ireland, and a man said, "Do you know Enfield?" Which is very intimate to my other version of Kempsey, which is Homebush. And I said, "Yes, it's just near where I grew up." And he said, "Well, my father cleared out at the end of the Civil War, and he went to an IRA gang troop, fettling crew, at Enfield, right, near Strathfield." And he said they said they're beautiful girls in Australia, but some of them already had fiancés back in Ireland. So they just worked for 7 to 10 years until it was safe to go back. Some of them went back on an amnesty because ultimately they had to come to terms with this phenomenon. And so Australia was not exempt from this. And Costigan, the Catholic gay who tormented very in this book, he's a dairy farmer way up on the Nulla, and he works the dairy for a a man who, on the night of July 19th, 1916, met Hitler. Because the Australians were directly opposite the 16th Bavarian Regiment, Bavarian Reserve Regiment, in which Hitler was a runner. And a number of Germans were captured that night and were let go the next morning as their own troops came back into the... And that's in the book too. So there's a fellow, an old farmer up in Kempsey, of him I was told, that old bloke reckons he took Hitler's pistol on the night of July 19. And it's quite possible, given Hitler was a runner. But you can't ask him because he'll shoot you, you know. So it was one of these self-protecting myths. The more the questions weren't asked of this old farmer, the more the myth grew. And I think it's... I've always been fascinated by our connections with the big world, you know, the fact that my father, a lot of Americans say, how come an Australian wrote this book? And I say, well, you know, if you forgive me, I was one degree of separation from from the Wehrmacht, from the Third Reich. My father sent all these memorabilia back from Egypt in and Libya and so on in Australian Comforts Fund cake tins. So at an early age, I was aware that there was this entity called the Reich. I used to see representations of it, propaganda representations in the pictures at the Vogue cinema, and then I had to put them together with these elements that came from either dead or captured boys. And so that's how I've always been fascinated by the connections between the old world and the new. And we have these fascinating connections with China too, which someone will write about, and the Qing dynasty and Sun Yat-sen.
So, does this writing gig get easier or harder as it goes on?
It gets more joyful.
Maybe finally today you could just answer for me the question that I was asked on the HSE exam about Bring Lux and Heroes, which was why you set it in a South Pacific colony rather than Sydney.
Well, it was because I had greater liberty to make things up. That sometimes happens, you just don't name the place. Of course, Sydney was called Sydney from early on, but Australia, that was a term that wasn't used until the Napoleonic era. And the maps were called New Holland, because in the mind of the imperialists, from Cape York on, it was Dutch. And on that basis, Cook claimed the East Coast from an island right on the border between Dutch Australia and... or he claimed to. What if he never claimed it? And it's all been a delusion. Well, we know it's... I mean, Mabo put the wood on us, and the Wick decision put the wood on us to look upon it as... and the voice will put the wood on us too. I hope it operates, but I'm just hoping there's a lot of people out there who don't want to admit to their mates that they're going to vote for the voice, but they are. It's going to be an interesting time afterwards, because where do we go? I'm hoping to make a little documentary, little rap concerning people my age and younger, but older folk, not... Don't go saying no. Don't leave this earth saying no and leave your grandchildren with that great unmalleable no. Another 200 years of bad policy.
I think that's a very valuable thing to do.
But the voice was there in 1933. So it is true that the past is the present in different lineaments, but the same questions. Mm.
Well, that's a lovely spot, I think, for us to finish up our discussion today. I've enjoyed it a lot. It's taken us over a lot of territory. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. And thanks to the Historical Novel Society.
It's the ARA Historical Novel Prize.
Yes, and I owe them a considerable debt.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2023 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many a luminary. Subscribe to the podcast series to be notified when new episodes drop. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's hip and happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.